of singers and tale-tellers. In the songs, Lan was a fellow who winkled the Castleys out of Castley Rock with no weapon but his wits, and stole gold from the sun to brighten his curly hair. Ned wished he were here now to winkle the truth out of this damnable book. A sharp rap on the door heralded Jorry Cassell. Ned closed Mallion's tome and bid him enter. "I promise the city watch 20 of my guard until the tourney is done," he told him. "I rely on you to make the choice. Give Alan the command, and make certain the men understand that they are needed to stop fights, not start them." Rising, Ned opened a cedar chest and removed a light linen undertunic. "Did you find the stable boy?" "The watchman, my lord," Jory said. "He vows he'll never touch another horse." "What do you have to say?" "He claims he knew Lord Aaron well. Fast friends they were," Jory snorted. "The hand always gave the lads a cuppa on their name days," he says. "Had a way with horses. Never rode his mounts too hard, and brought them carrots and apples, so they was always pleased to see him." "Carrots and apples," Ned repeated. "It sounds as if this boy would be even less use than the others." And he was the last of the four Littlefinger had turned up. Jory had spoken to each of them in turn. Sir Hugh had been brusque and uninformative and arrogant, as only a new-made knight can be. If the hand wished to talk to him, he should be pleased to receive him. But he would not be questioned by a mere captain of guards, even if said captain was 10 years older and 100 times a swordsman. The serving girl had at least been pleasant. She said Lord John had been reading more than was good for him, that he was troubled and melancholy over his young son's frailty, and gruff with his lady wife. The potboy, Noel Cordwainer, had never exchanged so much as a word with Lord John, but he was full of oddments of kitchen gossip. The Lord had been quarrelling with the king. The Lord only picked at his food. The Lord was sending his boy to be fostered on Dragonstone. The Lord had taken a great interest in the breeding of hunting hounds. The Lord had visited a master armourer to commission a new suit of plate, wrought all in plain silver, with a blue jasper falcon and a mother-of-pearl moon on the breast. The king's own brother had gone with him to help choose the design, the potboy said. No, not Lord Renly, the other one, Lord Stannis. Did our watchman recall anything else of note? The lad swears Lord John was as strong as a man half his age. Often went riding with Lord Stannis, he says. Stannis again, Ned thought. He found that curious. John Arryn and he had been cordial, but never friendly. And while Robert had been riding north to Winterfell, Stannis had removed himself to Dragonstone, the Targaryen island fastness he had conquered in his brother's name. He had given no word as to when he might return. "Where did they go on his rides?" Ned asked. "The boy said they visited a brothel." "A brothel?" Ned said. "The Lord of the Eyrie and Hand of the King visited a brothel with Stannis Baratheon?" He shook his head, incredulous, wondering what Lord Renly would make of this titbit. Robert's lusts were the subject of ribald drinking songs throughout the realm, but Stannis was a different sort of man, a bare year younger than the king, yet utterly unlike him, stern, humorless, unforgiving, grim in his sense of duty. "The boy insists it's true. The hand took 3 guardsmen with him, and the boy says they were joking of it when he took their horses afterwards." "Which brothel?" Ned asked. "The boy did not know. The guards would." "A pity Lysa carried them off to the Vale," Ned said dryly. "The guards are doing their best to vex us. Lady Lysa, Maester Coleman, Lord Stannis. Everyone who might actually know the truth of what happened to John Arryn is 1,000 leagues away. Will you summon Lord Stannis back from Dragonstone?" "Not yet," Ned said. "Not until I have a better notion of what this is all about and where he stands." The matter nagged at him. Why did Stannis leave? Had he played some part in John Arryn's murder? Or was he afraid? Ned found it hard to imagine what could frighten Stannis Baratheon, who had once held Storm's End through a year of siege, surviving on rats and boot leather, while the Lords Tyrell and Redwine sat outside with their hosts banqueting in sight of his walls. "Bring me my doublet, if you would, the grey with a direwolf sigil. I want this armour to know who I am. It might make him more forthcoming." Jorry went to the wardrobe. "Lord Renly is brother to Lord Stannis, as well as the king." "Yes, it seems that he was not invited on these rides." Ned was not sure what to make of Renly, with all his friendly ways and easy smiles. A few days passed, he had taken Ned aside to show him an exquisite rose-gold locket. Inside was a miniature, painted in the vivid Mearish style, of a lovely young girl with doe eyes and a cascade of soft brown hair. Renly had seemed anxious to know if the girl reminded him of anyone, and when Ned had no answer but a shrug, he seemed disappointed. The maid was Loras Tyrell's sister Marjorie, he'd confessed. But there were those who said she looked like Lyanna. "No," Ned had told him, bemused. Could it be that Lord Renly, who looked so like a young Robert, had conceived a passion for a girl he fancied to be young Lyanna? That struck him as more than passing queer. Jorry held out the doublet, and Ned slid his hands through the armhole. "Perhaps Lord Stannis will return for Robert's tourney," he said as Jorry laced the garment up the back. "That would be a stroke of fortune, my lord," Jorry said. Ned buckled on his longsword. "In other words, not bloody likely." His smile was grim. Jorry draped Ned's cloak across his shoulders and clasped it at the throat with a hand's badge of office. "The armourer lives above his shop, in a large house at the top of the Street of Steel. Alan knows the way, my lord." Ned nodded. "The guards help this putt-boy if he sent me off herring after shadows." It was a slim enough staff to lean on. The John Aaron that Ned Stark had known was not one to wear jeweled and silvered plate. Steel was steel. It was meant for protection, not ornament. He might have changed his views, to be sure. He would scarcely have been the first man who came to look on things differently after a few years at court. But the change was marked enough to make Ned wonder. "Is there any other service I might perform? I suppose you'd best begin visiting whorehouses." "Hard duty, my lord," Jorry grinned. "The men will be glad to help. Porter has made a fair start already." Ned's favourite horse was saddled and waiting in the yard. Varley and Jax fell in beside him as he rode through the yard. Their steel caps and shirts of mail must have been sweltering, yet they said no word of complaint. As Lord Eddard passed beneath the King's Gate into the stink of the city, his grey and white cloak streaming from his shoulders, he saw eyes everywhere and kicked his mount into a trot. His guard followed. He looked behind him frequently as they made their way through the crowded streets. Tamard and Desmond had left the castle early this morning to take up positions on the route they must take, and watch for anyone following them. But even so, Ned was uncertain. The shadow of the King's Spider and his little birds had him fretting like a maiden on her wedding night. The Street of Steel began at the Market Square beside the River Gate, as it was named on maps, or the Mud Gate, as it was commonly called. A mummer on stilts was striding through the throngs like some great insect, with a horde of barefoot children trailing behind him, hooting. Elsewhere, two ragged boys, no older than Bran, were dueling with sticks, to the loud encouragement of some and the furious curses of others. An old woman ended the contest by leaning out of her window and emptying a bucket of slops on the heads of the combatants. In the shadow of the wall, farmers stood beside their wagons, bellowing out, "Apples, the best apples, cheap at twice the price, and blood melons, sweet as honey, and turnips, onions, roots, here you go, turnips, onions, roots, here you go, here." The mud gate was opened, and a squad of city watchmen stood under the portcullis, in their golden cloaks leaning on spears. When a column of riders appeared from the west, the guardsmen sprang into action, shouting commands and moving the carts and foot traffic aside to let the knight enter with his escort. The first rider, through the gate, carried a long black banner. The silk rippled in the wind like a living thing. Across the fabric was blazoned a night sky slashed with purple lightning. "Make way for Lord Berwick!" the rider shouted. "Make way for Lord Berwick!" And close behind came the young lord himself, a dashing figure on a black courser, with red gold hair and a black satin cloak dusted with stars. "Here to fight in the Hands Tourney, my lord," a guardsman called out to him. "Here to win the Hands Tourney," Lord Berwick shouted back as the crowd cheered. Ned turned off the square where the Street of Steel began, and followed its winding path up a long hill, past blacksmiths working at open forges, free riders haggling over mail shirts, and grizzled ironmongers selling old blades and razors from their wagons. The farther they climbed, the larger the buildings grew. The man they wanted was all the way at the top of the hill, in a huge house of timber and plaster, whose upper stories loomed over the narrow street. The double doors showed a hunting scene carved in ebony and weirwood. A pair of stone knights stood sentry at the entrance, armoured in fanciful suits of polished red steel that transformed them into griffin and unicorn. Ned left his horse with Jax, and shouldered his way inside. The slim young serving girl took quick note of Ned's badge and the sigil on his doublet, and the master came hurrying out all smiles and bows. "Wine for the king's hand," he told the girl, gesturing Ned to a couch. "I am Topo Mutt, my lord. Please, please, put yourself at ease." He wore a black velvet coat, with hammers embroidered on the sleeves and silver thread. Around his neck was a heavy silver chain and a sapphire as large as a pigeon's egg. "If you are in need of new arms for the Hands Tourney, you've come to the right shop." Ned did not bother to correct him. "My work is costly, and I make no apologies for that, my lord," he said as he filled two matching silver goblets. "You will not find craftsmanship equal to mine anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms, I promise you. Visit every forge in King's Landing, if you like, and compare for yourself. Any village smith can hammer out a shirt of mail. My work is art." Ned sipped his wine and let the man go on. "The Knight of Flowers bought all his armor here," Tubbo boasted, "and many higher lords, the ones who knew fine steel, and even Lord Renly, the king's own brother. Perhaps the hand had seen Lord Renly's new armour, the green plate with the golden antlers. No other armour in the city could get that deeper green. He knew the secret of putting colour in the steel itself. Paint and enamel were the crutches of a journeyman. Or mayhaps the hand wanted a blade. Tubho had learned to work Valyrian steel at the forges of Kuhor as a boy. Only a man who knew the spells could take old weapons and forge them anew. The direwolf was a sigil of our stock, is it not? I could fashion a direwolf helm so real the children will run from you in the street," he vowed. Ned smiled. "Did you make a falcon helm for Lord Aaron?" Tophomart paused a long moment and set aside the wine. "The hand did call upon me with Lord Stannis, the king's brother. I regret to say they did not honour me with their patronage." Ned looked at the man evenly, saying nothing, waiting. He had found over the years that silence sometimes yielded more than questions, and so it was this time. "They asked to see the boy," the armourer said, "so I took them back to the forge." "The boy?" Ned echoed. He had no notion who the boy might be. "I should like to see the boy as well." Topo Mutt gave him a cool, careful look. "As you wish, my lord," he said, with no trace of his former friendliness. He led Ned out of a rear door and across a narrow yard back to the cavernous stone barn where the work was done. When the armourer opened the door, the blast of hot air that came through made Ned feel as though he was walking into a dragon's mouth. Inside, a forge blazed in each corner, and the air stank of smoke and sulphur. Journeymen armourers glanced up from their hammers and tongs just long enough to wipe the sweat from their brows, while bare-chested apprentice boys worked the bellows. The master called over a tall lad, about Rob's age, his arms and chest corded with muscle. "This is Lord Stark, the new hand of the king," he told him, as the boy looked at Ned through sullen blue eyes and pushed back sweat-soaked hair with his fingers. Thick hair, shaggy and unkempt, and black as ink. The shadow of a new beard darkened his jaw. "This is Gendry, strong for his age, and he works hard. Show the hand that helmet you made, lad." Almost shyly, the boy led them to his bench, and a steel helm shaped like a bull's head with two great curving horns. Ned turned the helm over in his hands. It was raw steel, unpolished, but expertly shaped. "This is fine work. I would be pleased if you would let me buy it." The boy snatched it out of his hands. "It's not for sale." Tobermut looked horror-struck. "Boy, this is the king's hand. If his lordship wants this helm, make him a gift of it. He honours you by asking." "I made it for me," the boy said stubbornly. 100 pardons, my lord," his master said hurriedly to Ned. "The boy is crude, as new steel, and like new steel would profit from some beating. That helm is journeyman's work at best. Forgive him, and I will promise I will craft you a helm like none you have ever seen."
"He has done nothing that requires my forgiveness. Gendry, when Lord Arryn came to see you, what did you talk about?"
"He asked me questions, is all, my lord."
"What sort of questions?"
The boy shrugged. "How was I, and was I well treated, and if I liked the work, and stuff about my mother, who she was, and what she looked like, and all."
"What did you tell him?" Ned asked. The boy shoved a fresh fall of black hair off his forehead.
"She died when I was little. She had yellow hair, and sometimes she used to sing to me, I remember. She worked in an alehouse."
"Did Lord Stannis question you as well?"
The bald one? No, not him. He never said no word, just glared at me, like I was some raper who'd done for his daughter.
"Mind the filthy tongue," the master said. "This is the king's own hand."
The boy lowered his eyes.
"A smart boy, eh? But stubborn. That helm. The others called him bull-headed, so he saw it in their teeth."
Ned touched the boy's head, fingering the thick black hair. "Look at me, Gendry." The apprentice lifted his face. Ned studied the shape of his jaw, the eyes like blue ice.
"Yes," he thought, "I see it."
"Go back to your work, lad. I am sorry to have bothered you." He walked back to the house with the master. "Who paid the boy's apprentice fee?" he asked lightly.
Mott looked fretful. "You saw the boy, such a strong boy. Those hands of his, those hands were made for hammers. He had such promise. I took him on without a fee."
"The truth now," Ned said. "The streets are full of strong boys. The day you take on an apprentice without a fee will be the day the wall comes down. Who paid for him?"
Lord, the master said reluctantly. "He gave no name, and wore no sigil on his coat. He paid in gold, twice the customary sum, and he said he was paying once for the boy and once for my silence."
"Describe him."
He was stout, round of shoulder, not so tall as you. Brown beard, but there was a bit of red in it elsewhere. He wore a rich cloak, that I do remember, heavy purple velvet worked with silver threads, but the hood shadowed his face, and I never did see him clear."
He hesitated a moment.
"My lord, I want no trouble."
"None of us wants trouble, but I fear these are troubled times, Master Mott," Ned said. You know who the boy is.
I'm only an armourer, my lord. I know what I'm told.
You know who the boy is, Ned repeated patiently. That is not a question.
The boy is my apprentice, the master said.
He looked Ned in the eye, stubborn as old iron.
Who he was before he came to me, that's none of my concern.
Ned nodded. He decided that he liked Tubhomot, Master Armourer. If the day ever comes when Gendry would rather wield a sword than forge one, send him to me. He has the look of a warrior. Until then, you have my thanks, Master Mott, and my promise. Should I ever want a helm to frighten children, this will be the first place I visit. His guard was waiting outside with the horses. Did you find anything, my lord? Jax asked, as Ned mounted up.
I did, Ned told him, wondering.
What had John Aaron wanted with a king's bastard? And why was it worth his life? Catelyn.
My lady, you ought to cover your head, Sir Roderick told her, as their horses plodded north. You will take a chill.
It's only water, Sir Roderick, Catelyn replied. Her hair hung wet and heavy, a loose strand stuck to her forehead, and she could imagine how ragged and wild she must look, but for once she did not care. The southern rain was soft and warm. Catelyn liked the feel of it on her face, gentle as her mother's kisses. It took her back to her childhood, to long grey days at Riverrun. She remembered the godswood, drooping branches heavy with moisture, and the sound of her brother's laughter as he chased her through piles of damp leaves. She remembered making mud pies with Lysa, the weight of them, the mud slick and brown between her fingers. They had served them to Littlefinger, giggling, and he'd eaten so much mud he was sick for a week. How young they all had been. Catelyn had almost forgotten. In the north the rain fell cold and hard, and sometimes at night it turned to ice. It was as likely to kill a crop as nurture it, and it sent grown men running for the nearest shelter. That was no rain for little girls to play in.
"I'm soaked through," Sir Roderick complained. "Even my bones are wet."
The woods pressed close around them, and the steady pattering of rain on leaves was accompanied by the small sucking sounds the horses made as their hooves pulled free of the mud.
"We will want a fire tonight, m'lady, and a hot meal would serve us both."
"There is an inn at the crossroad up ahead," Catelyn told him. She had slept many a night there in her youth, travelling with her father. Lord Huster Tully had been a restless man in his prime, always riding somewhere. She still remembered the innkeep, a fat woman named Masha Heddle, who chewed sour leaf night and day and seemed to have an endless supply of smiles and sweet cakes for the children. The sweet cakes had been soaked with honey, rich and heavy on the tongue. But how Catelyn had dreaded those smiles! The sour leaf had stained Masha's teeth a dark red and made her smile a bloody horror.
"An inn," Sir Roderick repeated wistfully. "If only. But we dare not risk it. If we wish to remain unknown, I think it best we seek out some small holdfast."
He broke off as they heard sounds up the road. Splashing water, the clink of mail, a horse's whinny.
"Riders," he warned, his hand dropping to the hilt of his sword. Even on the King's Road, it never hurt to be wary.
They followed the sounds around a lazy bend of the road and saw them, a column of armed men noisily fording a swollen stream. Catelyn reined up to let them pass. The banner in the hand of the foremost rider hung sodden and limp, but the guardsmen wore indigo cloaks, and on their shoulders flew the silver eagle of Seaguard.
"Malisters," Sir Roderick whispered to her, as if she had not known. "My lady, best pull up your hood."
Catelyn made no move. Lord Jason Malister himself rode with them, surrounded by his knights.
his son Patrick by his side, and their squires close behind. They were riding for King's Landing and the hounds Tawny, she knew. For the past week the travellers had been thick as flies upon the King's Road. Knights and free riders, singers with their harps and drums, heavy wagons laden with hops or corn or casks of honey, traders and craftsmen and whores, and all of them moving south. She studied Lord Jason Bolding. The last time she had seen him, he had been jesting with her uncle at her wedding feast. The Malisters stood bannermen to the Tullys, and his gifts had been lavish. His brown hair was salted with white now, his face chiseled gaunt by time. Yet the years had not touched his pride. He rode like a man who feared nothing. Catelyn envied him that. She had come to fear so much. As the riders passed, Lord Jason nodded a curt greeting, but it was only a high lord's courtesy to strangers chance met on the road. There was no recognition in those fierce eyes, and his son did not even waste a look.
"He did not know you," Sir Roderick said after, wondering.
He saw a pair of mud-spattered travellers by the side of the road, wet and tired. It would never occur to him to suspect that one of them was the daughter of his liege lord. "I think we shall be safe enough at the inn, Sir Roderick." It was near dark when they reached it, at the crossroads north of the great confluence of the Trident. Masha Heddle was fatter and greyer than Catelyn remembered, still chewing her sour leaf, but she gave them only the most cursory of looks, with nary hint of a ghastly red smile.
"Two rooms at the top of the stairs, that's all there is," she said, chewing all the while. "They're under the bell tower, so you won't be missing meals. Though there's some thinks it's too noisy. Can't be helped. We're full up. Or as near as makes no matter. It's those rooms or the road."
It was those rooms. Low, dusty garrets at the top of a cramped, narrow staircase.
"Leave your boots down here," Marcia told them, after she'd taken their coin. "The boy will clean them. I won't have you trekking mud up my stairs. Mind the bell. Those who come late to meals don't eat."
There were no smiles, and no mention of sweet cakes. When the supper bell rang, the sound was deafening. Catelyn had changed into dry clothes. She sat by the window, watching rain run down the pane. The glass was milky and full of bubbles, and a wet dusk was falling outside. Catelyn could just make out the muddy crossing where the two great roads met. The crossroads gave her pause. If they turned west from here, it was an easy ride down to River Run. Her father had always given her wise counsel when she needed it most, and she yearned to talk to him, to warn him of the gathering storm. If Winterfell needed to brace for war, how much more so River Run, so much closer to King's Landing, with a power of Casterly Rock looming to the west like a shadow. If only her father had been stronger, she might have chanced it. But Hoster Tully had been bedridden these past 2 years, and Catelyn was loath to tax him now. The eastern road was wilder and more dangerous, climbing through rocky foothills and thick forests into the Mountains of the Moon, past high passes and deep chasms to the Vale of Erin and the stony fingers beyond. Above the vale, the Eyrie stood high and impregnable, its towers reaching for the sky. There she would find her sister, and perhaps some of the answers Ned sought. Surely Lysa knew more than she had dared to put in a letter. She might have the very proof that Ned needed to bring the Lannisters to ruin, and if it came to war they would need the Aerons and the Eastern Lords who owed them service. Yet the mountain road was perilous. Shadow cats prowled those passes, rockslides were common, and the mountain clans were lawless brigands, descending from the heights to rob and kill, and melting away like snow whenever the knights rode out from the vale in search of them. Even John Aaron, as great a lord as any the Eyrie had ever known, had always travelled in strength
when he crossed the mountains. Catlin's only strength was one elderly knight, armored in loyalty. No, she thought, River Run and the Eyrie would have to wait. Her path ran north to Winterfell, where her sons and her duty were waiting for her. As soon as they were safely past the Neck, she could declare herself to one of Ned's bannermen and send riders racing ahead with orders to mount a watch on the King's Road. The rain obscured the fields beyond the crossroads, but Catelyn saw the land clear enough in her memory. The marketplace was just across the way, and the village a mile further on, half a hundred white cottages surrounding a small stone sept. There would be more now. The summer had been long and peaceful. North of here, the King's Road ran along the green fork of the Trident, through fertile valleys and green woodlands, past thriving towns and stout holdfasts and the castles of the River Lords. Catelyn knew them all, the Blackwoods and the Brackens, ever enemies whose quarrels her father was obliged to settle. Lady Went, last of her line, who dwelt with her ghosts in the cavernous vaults of Harrenhal. Irascible Lord Frey, who had outlived seven wives and filled his twin castles with children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and bastards and grand-bastards as well. All of them were bannermen to the Tullys, their swords sworn to the service of River Run. Catelyn wondered if that would be enough, if it came to war. Her father was the staunchest man who had ever lived, and she had no doubt that he would call his banners. But would the banners come? The Darrys and Rygers and Mutons had sworn oaths to River Run as well, yet they had fought with Rhaegar Targaryen on the Trident, while Lord Frey had arrived with his levies well after the battle was over, leaving some doubt as to which army he had planned to join. Theirs, he had assured the victors solemnly in the aftermath, but ever after her father had called him the late Lord Frey. It must not come to war, Catelyn thought fervently. They must not let it. Sir Roderick came for her just as the bell ceased its clangor. We'd best make haste, if we hope to eat tonight, my lady. It might be safer if we were not knight and lady until we passed the Neck, she told him. Common travellers attract less notice. A father and daughter taken to the road on some family business, eh? As you say, my lady, Sir Roderick agreed. It was only when she had laughed that he realized what he'd done. The old curses die hard, my daughter. He tried to tug on his missing whiskers and sighed with exasperation. Catelyn took his arm. Come, father, she said. You'll find that Masha Heddle sets a good table, I think, but try not to praise her. You truly don't want to see her smile. The common room was long and draughty, with a row of huge wooden kegs at one end and a fireplace at the other. A serving boy ran back and forth with skewers of meat while Masha drew beer from the kegs, chewing her sour leaf all the while. The benches were crowded, townsfolk and farmers mingling freely with all manner of travellers. The crossroads made for odd companions. Dyers, with black and purple hands, shared a bench with rivermen reeking of fish. An ironsmith, thick with muscle, squeezed in between a wizened old septon. Hard-bitten sellswords and soft, plump merchants swapped news like boon companions. The company included more swords than Catelyn would have liked. Three by the fire wore the red stallion badge of the Brackens, and there was a large party in blue steel ringmail and capes of silvery grey. On their shoulder was another familiar sigil, the twin towers of House Frey. She studied their faces, but they were all too young to have known her. The senior among them would have been no older than Bran when she went north. Sir Roderick found them an entry place on the bench near the kitchen. Across the table, a handsome youth was fingering a wood harp. "Seven blessings to you, good folk," he said as they sat. An empty wine cup stood on the table before him. "And to you, Singer," Catlin returned. Sir Roderick called for bread and meat and beer, in a tone that meant now. The Singer, a youth of some 18 years, eyed them boldly and asked where they were going, and from whence they had come, and what news they had, letting the questions fly as quick as arrows and never pausing for an answer. "We left King's Landing a fortnight ago," Catlin replied, answering the safest of his questions. "Oh, that's where I'm bound," the youth said. As she had suspected, he was more interested in telling his own story than hearing theirs. Singers love nothing half so well as the sound of their own voices. "The hands tawny means rich lords with fat purses. The last time I came away with more silver than I could carry, or would have, if I hadn't lost it all betting on the King's Slayer to win the day." "The gods frown on the gambler," Sir Roderick said sternly. He was of the North and shared the stark views on tournaments. "They frowned on me for certain," the Singer said. "Your cruel gods and the Knight of Flowers all together did me in." "No doubt there was a lesson for you," Sir Roderick said. "It was. This time, my coin will champion Sir Loris." Sir Roderick tried to tug at whiskers that were not there. But before he could frame a rebuke, the serving boy came scurrying up. He laid trenchers of bread before them and filled them with chunks of browned meat off a skewer, dripping with hot juice. Another skewer held tiny onions, fire peppers, and fat mushrooms. Sir Roderick set to lustily as the lad ran back to fetch some beer. "My name is Marillion," the Singer said, plucking a string on his wood harp. "Doubtless you've heard me play somewhere." His manner made Catlin smile. Few wandering singers ever ventured as far north as Winterfell, but she knew his like from her girlhood in Riverrun. "I fear not," she told him. He drew a plaintive chord from his wood harp. "That is your loss," he said. "Who was the finest singer you've ever heard?"
"Elia of Braavos,"
Sir Roderick answered at once. "Oh, much better than that old stick," Marillion said. "If you have the silver for a song, I'll gladly show you."
"I might have a copper or two, but I'd sooner toss it down a well than pay for your harling,"
Sir Roderick grasped. His opinion of singers was well known. Music was a lovely thing for girls, but he could not comprehend why any healthy boy would fill his hand with a harp when he might have had a sword. "Your grandfather has a sour nature," Marillion said to Catlin.
"I meant to do you honour, an homage to your beauty. In truth, I was made to sing for kings and high lords."
"Oh, I can see that," Catlin said. "Lord Tully is fond of song, I hear. No doubt you've been to Riverrun."
100 times, the Singer said airily. "They keep a chamber for me, and the young lord is like a brother."
Catlin smiled, wondering what Edmure would think of that. Another singer had once bedded a girl her brother fancied, and he had hated the breed ever since. "And Winterfell," she asked him, "have you travelled north?"
"Why would I?" Marillion asked. "It's all blizzards and bearskins up there, and the Starks know no music but the howling of wolves."
Distantly she was aware of the door banging open at the far end of the room.
"Innkeep," a servant's voice called out behind her. "We have horses that want stabling, and my lord of Lannister requires a room and a hot bath."
"Oh, gods," Sir Roderick said, before Catlin reached out to silence him, her fingers tightening around his forearm. Masha Heddle was bowing and smiling her hideous red smile.
"I'm sorry, my lord, truly. We're full up, every room."
There were 4 of them, Catlin saw. An old man in the black of the night's watch, 2 servants, and him, standing there, small and bold as life.
"My men will sleep in your stable, and as for myself, well, I do not require a large room, as you can plainly see."
He flashed a mocking grin. "So long as the fire's warm and the straw reasonably free of fleas, I am a happy man." Masha Heddle was beside herself.
My lord, there's nothing. It's a tawny. There's no help for it.
Tyrion Lannister pulled a coin from his purse and flicked it up over his head, caught it, tossed it up again. Even across the room where Catelyn sat, the wink of gold was unmistakable. A free rider in a faded blue cloak lurched to his feet.
"You're welcome to my room, my lord."
"Now there's a clever man," Lannister said as he sent the coin spinning across the room. The free rider snatched it from the air.
"And a nimble one to boot."
The dwarf turned back to Masha Heddle.
"You will be able to manage food, I trust."
"Anything you like, my lord, anything at all,"
the innkeep promised.
"And may he choke on it,"
Catelyn thought. But it was Bran she saw, choking, drowning on his own blood. Lannister glanced at the nearest tables.
"My men will have whatever you're serving these people. Double portions. We've had a long, hard ride. I'll take a roast fowl, chicken, duck, pigeon, it makes no matter. And send up a flagon of your best wine. Yaren, will you sup with me?"
"Aye, my lord, I will,"
the Black Brother replied. The dwarf had not so much as glanced toward the far end of the room, and Catelyn was thinking how grateful she was for the crowded benches between them, when suddenly Merillion bounded to his feet.
"My lord of Lannister," he called out, "I would be pleased to entertain you while you eat. Let me sing you the lay of your father's great victory at King's Landing."
"Nothing would be more likely to ruin my supper," the dwarf said dryly.
His mismatched eyes considered the singer briefly, started to move away, and found Catelyn. He looked at her for a moment, puzzled. She turned her face away, but too late. The dwarf was smiling.
"Lady Stark, oh, what an unexpected pleasure," he said. "I was sorry to miss you at Winterfell."
Merillion gaped at her, confusion giving way to chagrin, as Catelyn rose slowly to her feet. She heard Sir Roderick curse. If only the man had lingered at the wall, she thought, if only.
"Lady Stark," Masha Heddle said thickly.
"I was still Catelyn Tully the last time I bedded here," she told the innkeeper. She could hear the muttering, feel the eyes upon her. Catelyn glanced around the room, at the faces of the knights and sworn swords, took a deep breath to slow the frantic beating of her heart. Did she dare take the risk? There was no time to think it through. Only the moment and the sound of her own voice ringing in her ears. "You in the corner," she said to an older man she had not noticed until now. "Is that the black bat of Harrenhal I see embroidered on your surcoat, sir?" The man got to his feet.
"It is, my lady."
"And his lady went a true and honest friend to my father, Lord Huster Tully of Riverrun?"
"She is," the man replied stoutly.
Sir Roderick rose quietly and loosened his sword in its scabbard. The dwarf was blinking at them, blank-faced, with puzzlement in his mismatched eyes. "The Red Stallion was ever a welcome sight at River Run," she said to the trio by the fire. "My father counts Jonas Bracken amongst his oldest and most loyal bannermen." The three men-at-arms exchanged uncertain looks. "Our lord is honored by his trust," one of them said hesitantly.
"I envy your father all these fine friends," Lannister quipped. "But I do not quite see the purpose of this, Lady Stark."
She ignored him, turning to the large party in blue and grey. They were the heart of the matter. There were more than 20 of them. "I know your sigil as well, the Twin Towers of Frey. How fares your good lord, sirs?" Their captain rose.
"Lord Walder is well, my lady. He promises to take a new wife on his 90th name day, and has asked your lord father to honour the wedding with his presence."
Tyrion Lannister sniggered. That was when Catelyn knew he was hers. This man came as a guest into my house, and there conspired to murder my son, a boy of 7, she proclaimed to the room at large, pointing. Sir Roderick moved to her side, his sword in hand. In the name of King Robert, and the good lords you serve, I call upon you to seize him and help me return him to Winterfell to await the king's justice. She did not know what was a more satisfying, the sound of a dozen swords drawn as one, or the look on Tyrion Lannister's face. Sansa rode to the Hand's Tourney with Septa Mordane and Jane Poole, in a litter with curtains of yellow silk, so fine she could see right through them. They turned the whole world gold. Beyond the city walls, 100 pavilions had been raised beside the river, and the common folk came out in the thousands to watch the games. The splendor of it all took Sansa's breath away. The shining armor, the great chargers, caparisoned in silver and gold, the shouts of the crowd, the banners snapping in the wind, and the knights themselves, the knights, most of all. "It is better than the songs," she whispered, when they found the places that her father had promised her, among the high lords and ladies. Sansa was dressed beautifully that day, in a green gown that brought out the auburn of her hair, and she knew they were looking at her and smiling. They watched the heroes of 100 songs ride forth, each more fabulous than the last. The 7 knights of the King's Guard took the field, all but Jaime Lannister, in scaled armor the color of milk, their cloaks as white as fresh-fallen snow. Sir Jaime wore the white cloak as well, but beneath it he was shining gold from head to foot, with a lion's head helm and a golden sword. Sir Gregor Clegane, the mountain that rides, thundered past them like an avalanche. Sansa remembered Lord Jon Royce, who had guested at Winterfell 2 years before. "His armor is bronze, thousands and thousands of years old, engraved with magic runes that ward him against harm," she whispered to Jane. Septa Mordane pointed out Lord Jason Mallister, in indigo chased with silver, the wings of an eagle on his helm. He had cut down 3 of Rhaegar's bannermen on the Trident. The girls giggled over the warrior priest, Thoris of Myr, with his flapping red robes and shaven head, until the scepter told them that he had once scaled the walls of Pyke with a flaming sword in hand. Other riders, Sansa did not know, hedge knights from the Fingers and Highgarden and the Mountains of Dawn, unsung free riders and new-made squires, the younger sons of high lords and the heirs of lesser houses. Younger men, most had done no great deeds as yet, but Sansa and Jane agreed that one day the 7 kingdoms would resound to the sound of their names. Sir Balon Swan, Lord Bryce Caron of the Marches, Bronze Yon's heir, Sir Andar Royce, and his younger brother, Sir Robar, their silver steel plate filigreed in bronze with the same ancient runes that warded their father. The twins, Sir Horace and Sir Hubba, whose shields displayed the grape cluster sigil of the Red Wines, burgundy on blue. Patrick Mallister, Lord Jason's son. 6 Freys of the Crossing. Sir Jared, Sir Hustine, Sir Danwell, Sir Emmon, Sir Theo, Sir Perwin, sons and grandsons of old Lord Walder Frey, and his bastard son Martin Rivers as well. Jane Poole confessed herself frightened by the look of Jalabar Zo, an exiled prince from the Summer Isles who wore a cape of green and scarlet feathers over skin as dark as night. But when she saw young Lord Beric Dondarrion, with his hair like red gold and his black shield slashed by lightning, she pronounced herself willing to marry him on the instant. The Hound entered the list as well, and so too the king's brother, handsome Lord Renly of Storm's End. Jory, Alan, and Harwin rode for Winterfell on the north. "Jory looks a beggar amongst these others," Septa Mordane sniffed when he appeared. Sansa could only agree. Jory's armor was blue-gray plate without device or ornament,
and a thin grey cloak hung from his shoulders like a soiled rag. Yet he acquitted himself well, unhorsing Horace red wine in his first joust, and one of the frays in his second. In his third match he rode three passes at a free rider named Lothar Brun, whose armour was as drab as his own. Neither man lost his seat, but Brun's lance was steadier and his blows better placed, and the king gave him the victory. Alan and Harwin fared less well. Harwin was unhorsed in his first tilt by Sir Merrin of the King's Guard, while Alan fell to Sir Balan Swan. The jousting went on all day and into the dusk, the hooves of the great war horses pounding down the lists until the field was a ragged wasteland of torn earth. A dozen times Jane and Sansa cried out in unison as riders crashed together, lances exploding into splinters, while the common screamed for their favourites. Jane covered her eyes whenever a man fell, like a frightened little girl, but Sansa was made of sterner stuff. A great lady knew how to behave at tournaments. Even Septa Mordane noted her composure and nodded in approval. The Kingslayer rode brilliantly. He overthrew Sir Andar Royce and the marcher Lord Bryce Caron as easily as if he were riding at rings, and then took a hard-fought match from white-haired Barristan Selmyr, who had won his first two tilts against men 30 and 40 years his junior. Sandor Clegane and his immense brother, Sir Gregor the Mountain, seemed unstoppable as well, riding down one foe after the next in ferocious style. The most terrifying moment of the day came during Sir Gregor's second joust, when his lance rode up and struck a young knight from the Vale under the gorget with such force that it drove through his throat, killing him instantly. The youth fell not 10 feet from where Sansa was seated. The point of Sir Gregor's lance had snapped off in his neck, and his life's blood flowed out in slow pulses, each weaker than the one before. His armour was shiny new. A bright streak of fire ran down his outstretched arm as the steel caught the light. Then the sun went behind a cloud, and it was gone. His cloak was blue, the colour of the sky on a clear summer's day, trimmed with a border of crescent moons, but as his blood seeped into it, the cloth darkened and the moons turned red, one by one. Jane Poole wept so hysterically that Septa Mordane finally took her off to regain her composure, but Sansa sat with her hands folded in her lap, watching with a strange fascination. She had never seen a man die before. She ought to be crying, too, she thought, but the tears would not come. Perhaps she had used up all her tears for Lady and Bran. It would be different if it had been Jory or Sir Roderick or father, she told herself. The young knight in the blue cloak was nothing to her, some stranger from the Vale of Arryn, whose name she had forgotten as soon as she heard it. And now the world would forget his name, too, Sansa realized. There would be no song sung for him. That was sad. After they carried off the body, a boy with a spade ran onto the field and shoveled dirt over the spot where he had fallen to cover up the blood. Then the joust resumed. Sir Balon Swan also fell to Gregor, and Lord Renly to the Hound. Renly was on horse so violently that he seemed to fly backward off his charger, legs in the air. His head hit the ground with an audible crack that made the crowd gasp, but it was just the golden antler on his helm. One of the tines had snapped off beneath him. When Lord Renly climbed to his feet, the commons cheered wildly, for King Robert's handsome young brother was a great favourite. He handed the broken tine to his conqueror with a gracious bow. The hound snorted and tossed the broken antler into the crowd, where the commons began to punch and claw over the little bit of gold, until Lord Renly walked out among them and restored the peace. By then, Septa Mordane had returned, alone. Jane had been feeling ill, she explained. She had helped her back to the castle. Sansa had almost forgotten about Jane. Later, a hedge knight in a checkered cloak disgraced himself by killing Beric Dondarrion's horse and was declared forfeit. Lord Beric shifted his saddle to a new mount, only to be knocked right off by Thoris of Myr. Sir Aaron Santigar and Lothar Brune tilted thrice without result. Sir Aaron fell afterwards to Lord Jason Malister, and Brune to Jan Royce's younger son, Robar. In the end, it came down to four: the Hound and his monstrous brother, Gregor, Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, and Sir Loras Tyrell, the youth they called the Knight of Flowers. Sir Loras was the younger son of Mace Tyrell, the Lord of High Garden and Warden of the South. At 16, he was the youngest rider on the field, yet he had unhorsed 3 knights of the King's Guard that morning in his first 3 jousts. Sansa had never seen anyone so beautiful. His plate was intricately fashioned and enameled as a bouquet of 1,000 different flowers, and his snow-white stallion was draped in a blanket of red and white roses. After each victory, Sir Loras would remove his helm and ride slowly round the fence, and finally pluck a single white rose from the blanket and toss it to some fair maiden in the crowd. His last match of the day was against the younger Royce. Sir Robar's ancestral runes proved small protection, as Sir Loras split his shield and drove him from his saddle to crash with an awful clangor in the dirt. Robar lay moaning as the victor made his circuit of the field. Finally, they called for a litter and carried him off to his tent, dazed and unmoving. Sansa never saw it. Her eyes were only for Sir Loras. When the white horse stopped in front of her, she thought her heart would burst. To the other maidens he had given white roses, but the one he plucked for her was red. "Sweet lady," he said, "no victory is half so beautiful as you." Sansa took the flower timidly, struck dumb by his gallantry. His hair was a mass of lazy brown curls, his eyes like liquid gold. She inhaled the sweet fragrance of the rose and sat clutching it long after Sir Loras had ridden off. When Sansa finally looked up, a man was standing over her staring. He was short, with a pointed beard and a silver streak in his hair, almost as old as her father. "You must be one of her daughters," he said to her. He had grey-green eyes that did not smile when his mouth did. "You have the Tully look." "I am Sansa Stark," she said, ill at ease. The man wore a heavy cloak with a fur collar, fastened with a silver mockingbird, and he had the effortless manner of a high lord. But she did not know him. "I have not had the honour, my lord." Septa Mordaine quickly took a hand. "Sweet child, this is Lord Petar Baelish of the King's Small Council." "Your mother was my queen of beauty once," the man said quietly. His breath smelled of mint. "You have her hair." His fingers brushed against her cheek as he stroked one auburn lock. Quite abruptly he turned and walked away. By then the moon was well up, and the crowd was tired, so the king decreed that the last 3 matches were to be fought the next morning before the melee. While the commons began their walk home, talking of the day's jousts and the matches to come on the morrow, the court moved to the riverside to begin the feast. 6 monstrous huge aurochs had been roasting for hours, turning slowly on wooden spits, while kitchen boys basted them with butter and herbs until the meat crackled and spit. Tables and benches had been raised outside the pavilions, piled high with sweet grass and strawberries and fresh-baked bread. Sansa and Septa Mordaine were given places of high honour to the left of the raised dais, where the king himself sat beside his queen. When Prince Joffrey seated himself to her right, she felt her throat tighten. He had not spoken a word to her since the awful thing had happened, and she had not dared to speak to him. At first she thought she hated him for what they'd done to Lady, but after Sansa had wept her eyes dry, she told herself it had not been Joffrey's doing, not truly. The queen had done it. She was the one to hate, her and Arya. Nothing bad would have happened except for Arya. She could not hate Joffrey tonight. He was too beautiful to hate. He wore a deep blue doublet studded with a double row of golden lion's heads, and around his brow a slim coronet made of gold and sapphires. His hair was as bright as a metal. Sansa looked at him and trembled, afraid